From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Songs of Madness and music from Jane Austen's songbooks, we talk with soprano Julianne Baird, who specializes in early music. She'll tell us about learning to reconstruct the singing styles of earlier centuries. Then we'll hear from pianist Andrew Rangel, who's making a comeback after a long break caused by tendonitis. He'll tell us why he took on the all-consuming challenge of learning Beethoven's cycle of 32 sonatas. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new memoir by Wendy Lesser, the founder of the Three Penny Review, a journal of literature and arts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Julianne Baird, has been described in the New York Times as one of the most recorded and distinguished sopranos of the early music movement. Classical music critic David Patrick Stearns wrote, "Her voice gives a distinctive incandescence to everything she sings." Baird has performed with many major orchestras, including the New York Philharmonic, the Cleveland Orchestra, and the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. She's also a scholar of early music and has taught at Princeton University and the New England Conservatory of Music. She's now on the faculty of Rutgers University. Her recent recordings have focused on fascinating themes in and beyond early music, such as English songs about madness, music from Jane Austen's songbooks, parlor songs, lullabies, and her latest, a collection of Lieder by Fanny Mendelssohn. Let's start with a song from the Jane Austen songbook. This is Silent Worship by Handel. Julianne Baird, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Now, you specialize in what's described as early music. So what period are we specifically talking about when we use the word early music?
Well, I think these days we talk about anything from Middle Ages through, certainly through Mozart, and of course with people like Roger Norrington and recordings of Beethoven and Berlioz. It's been extended with Brahms all the way through the Romantic era, and that we generally call historically informed performances or performances on original instruments.
What do you love about that period?
I think what I love the most is the fact that the performer had a voice. Music was regarded as a blueprint, and without the performer's input to bring it alive, it wasn't considered a complete art. And what I experienced in conservatory, and I think a lot of my colleagues did too, is that there was a kind of a holy attitude about music that one must totally prostrate oneself to, and that individual input was not valued. And of course, in Baroque music, without it, you're not really performing it correctly. So I think it reflects my desire to put my two cents in.
Are there differences in singing early music, technically? What a singer's expected to do, the quality of voice he or she is expected to have compared to more contemporary classical singing?
Well, certainly you need to have a lighter voice, I think, in general, than what we think of as the kind of voice that would cover, that would be strong enough to fill the Metropolitan Opera. Because there you need, volume is probably the first criterion. It's most important to be loud. Maybe beauty is also important, but maybe not even as important as how loud you can sing. And to be an early music singer, to be able to get around those fast passages, you have to have a certain amount of flexibility. So an easy kind of production that allows for a lot of agility. It can't be too quiet. We know that styles of music changed. For example, certain ornaments that they did in Monteverdi's era, which were in a small room and easily able to be heard, did not work in a 500-seat opera house. Even when they moved to houses that only had 500 seats, the styles changed to a certain extent. So we get in some of the books on singing, them making fun of singers who were still doing what they called chicken cackling, namely something that sound, they said that it was the sound that a chicken made after laying an egg. But that same style was exactly what you wanted in 1600, whereas in 1700 it was truly a laughable thing.
Could you demonstrate that chicken cackling?
They were talking about a kind of light, might call it a sort of a giggle against the soft palate, which books call the trillo, sort of ha 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 ha. It's kind of a quick motion of the glottis. And, of course, that's not an ornament that's going to carry in a big room. And so they began to make a lot of fun of that, and they wanted a more, I'd say, projected sound, probably. They even talk about differences in the way the articulation should be done, so that whereas a very distinct articulation might have a lot of vowels said on each note, ha 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 ha, by the time we get to the middle Baroque, they're not wanting that anymore. They want one articulation followed through, ha. If that helps to describe a little bit.
Let's talk about vibrato. Do you use a different kind of vibrato or any more or less of it when you're singing early music than when you're singing more contemporary art song?
Well, I'd have to say yes. For one thing, in the instrumental treatises, we learned that vibrato was to be used sparingly. And they tell you specifically, it's not until 1750 or so that we get a book on violin playing that says you should make vibrato all the time. And even in Brahms' violin concerto, there are places where Joachim, it was marked that he made the vibrato. So this concept of vibrato all the time even wasn't the case in the 19th century, in the Romantic era, which is kind of fascinating for people. But in singing, and particularly in singing early music, there are written out ornaments that we know were specifically for vibrato. I showed you the trillo, which is that kind of throat articulation. There was another kind of trillo for Monteverdi's era that involved more diaphragmatic articulation, and in a way a kind of quote-unquote vibrato. Maybe like, if I can demonstrate it, sort of like this. Ah, sing. If you will, what I'm doing is just kind of contracting my stomach muscles to make a sort of intensity vibrato. And they would use that kind of technique on a word like tears or suffering or crying, weeping. And so that's a specific kind of a vibrato that gets used in certain situations. Even by the time we get to Bach, he writes out a vibrato. He calls it a Bebung. And it looks kind of like a wavy line that goes on and on. And he recommends, for example, in the St. John Passion, that that's the kind of ornament that is used on the word death. So it's interesting. There are specific ways of writing vibrato. And also it was used in Purcell to indicate cold, sort of fear and cold. So they actually used it.
So is it like a dramatic underscore?
Mm-hmm. Very much. So if you're using, it's really hard if you're vibrating all the time to make that a special effect, you see.
Now, I want to play another song from one of your records, and this is a CD entirely given over to what you describe as English mad songs and airs. And these are all songs about madness and depression and suicide. Mm-hmm. And this is a song by Purcell. Are you doing any of the things that you talked about in this song?
Yes, a lot of note bending, if you will, a lot of sliding between notes. That's another thing we think of as kind of a later phenomenon, but they had this strange kind of glide and slide, and the whole point was to proceed from one note to another imperceptibly, so you didn't really realize when you got from one to the other. So it's kind of this real slow slide.
Well, this song is called With Sick and Famished Eyes. Would you just recite the lyric for us?
Sure. With sick and famished eyes, with doubling knees and weary bones, to thee my cries, to thee my groans, to thee my sighs, my tears ascend. No end? My throat, my soul is hoarse. My heart is withered like a ground which thou dost curse. my thoughts turn round and make me giddy. Lord, Lord, I fall, yet call.
And this is Julianne Baird. That's Julianne Baird with Colin Tilney at the harpsichord from Julianne Baird's album English Mad Songs and Airs. Julianne, how come you did a whole album of songs about madness? They're really interesting songs.
Well, I think it had to do mostly with loving Purcell so much, mm-hmm. and also the realization that it was a fascinating time in English history, because the insane asylums for the first time were open to the public for a penny. You could go through the insane asylums and look at the most strange cases of madness. And instead of going to the zoo, that's what the English did during this time. So their diaries full of descriptions of what the insane asylums were like, especially Bedlam, which was Bethlehem, was one of the most notorious of those. And the prisoners slept on straw and naked. But most interesting is the fact that women were locked up at a rate three times to what men were. And they judged the kind of inmate duty that they had to do by the degree of their insanity. So the melancholy ironed, and those that were really violent had to do the heavy washing, you know, the sort of grasping of the fabric and moving it around. And so it's just a fascinating era.
Was there an actual genre called mad songs?
Yes. Yes.
And who wrote them? Just the composers of the day, or these people who had themselves been institutionalized at some point?
Well, Jonathan Swift became very fascinated with the whole idea because he was institutionalized in such a place. But Purcell and Blow and other composers of that time wrote
mad songs. We're
talking
17th century.
17th century. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very interesting. And did you find that the music was colored by the melancholy of the lyrics?
Yes, in fact, their word melancholy, they used for our word depression.
Right.
And so they had the different states of madness depicted. Sometimes in one song you'd have four or five different kinds of madness. So they really loved going from these variety of states. It meant that the pieces often are very sectional, very short sections, all kind of glued together. So you get mirthfully mad and melancholy madness and stark madness and et cetera.
Were these pop songs of their day?
In as much as they were performed probably in a court setting, they were probably performed for people that were rather privileged. I don't think the hoi polloi probably heard these so very much. We know that you had to have a little bit of money to go through the insane asylum, and it had become kind of the idle pastimes of the rich to go to the insane asylum. So I think it probably reflected what they were seeing and hearing more than the common people.
My guest is soprano Julianne Baird. Her latest CD is Lieder by Fanny Mendelssohn. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is soprano Julianne Baird. There was a period in your career when you described yourself as a musicologist who sings.
Yes.
I'm not sure you still describe yourself that way. You're a kind of acclaimed enough singer that you are a singer who's a musicologist, I think.
That's right, I think.
But why did you shift the balance toward musicology earlier in your career?
Well, to tell you the truth, part of it was that I didn't trust that I could become a singer.
Mm-hmm.
And I had plenty of indication. It wasn't that I was being told, you're going to be a singer, just be a singer. And it was also my own cautiousness and needing to have a good day job, as it were. And I came from an academic family where that was a natural course of behavior, you know, studying and going to libraries kind of thing. And to tell you the truth, in the discipline that I chose, it's valuable because you need to do a certain amount of your own research and finding pieces. For example, that piece, The Sick and Famished Eyes, doesn't exist in any regular songbook for singers. You have to go digging to find that piece.
No, I believe that you started singing by singing shape note singing. And why don't you describe what shape note singing is?
Well, my family of origin lived in Appalachia. Still, my grandfather's still alive and still living on the old family homestead. And singing was one of the things that we did for fun. It was entertainment. And my grandparents were both very much into the Baptist church, and they loved to sing hymns as a pastime. But neither one could read music. So what they do, what shape note singing is there are certain shapes to the notes which indicate what pitch they are. And even though these days they're written on a staff, so that me, today, I could look at it and say, that's a G. It's written on one line, and it's therefore a G. They didn't know that that was a G. They just knew that it was a certain shape and that that meant to sing that note. So it was interesting. They loved to sing, and they just howled away. It was really very piercing kind of vocal production that goes with that.
How did you find classical singing?
Well, when I was in middle school, my mother suggested that she thought I had a voice and that I should go and sing to the music teachers in school. And before then, I guess it had been commented on in my family that I had a nice voice. But it came to be something that I could do that not that many other people were doing. At least it was a way for me to distinguish myself. And so I sang through high school and applied to several conservatories, was rejected by some, but then ended up going to the Eastman School of Music, where I immediately changed out of being a voice major.
Why?
Because I felt like I was no dummy. I could tell that what they really wanted was a big vibrato and a huge voice, and I knew I was a square peg and that was never going to fit. And so rather than have them try to tell me, sort of, you're not going to make this work, I said, okay, I'm going to change my major. I'm going to be a musicologist, and then I'll get to sing, and no one can attack me for singing what I want to sing.
Well, it worked.
It did. It actually did.
Well, speaking of not singing with the loudest voice, you have an album of lullabies.
Yes.
And I thought this would be a nice opportunity to hear
some
soft singing. And this is from a CD called Lullabies, A Songbook Companion, and it's produced by the Metropolitan Museum of Art in conjunction, I guess, with a show that they did.
Well, they decided to publish a book on lullabies, and they wanted to have some of the lullabies demonstrated so that people maybe who didn't read music could buy the record.
Well, this is a familiar lullaby we're going to hear all through the night.
Sleep, my child, and peace attend thee all through the night.
That's Julianne Baird singing All Through the Night from the CD Lullabies, a Songbook Companion. That's really lovely.
Oh, thank you.
Did you sing lullabies to your children?
Sure.
In a soft voice?
In a soft voice, it's true. And in fact, it's tough being a singer with kids in the sense that they also recognize that that's part of your profession and it's the thing that makes mom go away also. So I think kids, children of singers, probably have a, I don't want to say a love-hate relationship, but they recognize that it's two-sided. You know, mom sings, she sings to you, but she also goes away to sing.
Julianne Baird, it's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
Julianne Baird's latest CD is Leader by Fanny Mendelssohn. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support comes from Villard Books, publishers of Running to the Mountain, A Journey of Faith and Change by John Katz, and Pantheon Books, publisher of Anne Lamott's latest book, Traveling Mercies, Some Thoughts on Faith, available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, pianist Andrew Rangel on the complete cycle of Beethoven sonatas, intimate piano works, and tendonitis. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new memoir by Wendy Lesser, the founder of the Three Penny Review. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has described Andrew Rangel as a stellar pianist. We often play Rangel's recordings in between interviews on our show, and when we do, we usually get calls from listeners who want to hear more. So we invited him on the show. In the 80s, Rangel took on the monumental challenge of performing all 32 Beethoven piano sonatas. In a review of a Beethoven recital, music critic Anthony Tomasini wrote that Rangel has some of the best, most polyphonical, independent fingers around. Unfortunately, Rangel's hands rebelled with tendonitis 7 years ago, forcing him to take a break from recording and performing. In the past couple of years, he's been making a comeback. Before we meet Rangel, let's hear a selection from his latest CD, Intimate Works. This is Mozart's Rondo in A minor. Andrew Rangel, welcome to Fresh Air. In the liner notes of the CD, A Recital of Intimate Works, the liner notes that you wrote, you quote Francis Bacon, who said, "There is no excellent beauty that hath not some strangeness in the proportion." And I'm wondering how that intriguing quote relates to your interpretations of music and your choices of music.
That quotation came up as a kind of an afterthought or an after impression as I considered what was included in that repertoire on that disc. Of course, the disc is called Intimate Pieces. Even that designation was added on later as a title, but the works that are on that disc all do have a kind of particularly interior and probing, searching quality for the most part, and an intimate quality. There was, in fact, at the time, a practical reason, because all of those things were recorded at a point in my career when I was undergoing tremendous physical problems and wanted, in fact, to gather together a group of works which meant a great deal to me, but and which I wanted to record and perform, but which I felt constituted less of a potential problem of execution than certain other pieces.
What actually did happen to your hand that forced you to stop performing for a while?
Well, the problem was precipitated in the spring of 1991 during an especially stressful, sustained 5-day recording session during which I was trying with increasing difficulty and increasing alarm to record the last 3 Beethoven sonatas, very demanding pieces of immense personal importance to me. And as you can imagine, this is a highly pressurized situation. There are time constraints. And I noticed certain small stirrings in my right hand that produced a considerable anxiety. At that time, they were not disabling problems, but I would just say that 5 to 6 weeks later, as I was trying to prepare for a very important recital, I really had a full-blown case of tendonitis where, you know, I could barely open and close my hand or hold things, and at that point, that was a real trauma, and that sort of set in motion a kind of downward spiral, which I didn't really anticipate would last a long time. Unfortunately, it was a nightmare which lasted many years.
What advice did you get from doctors?
Oh, well, my desperate attempts to find doctors is a saga that is kind of amazing. I got, of course, a huge variety of advice and suggestions and, you know, every kind of test. The problem was that I couldn't at the outset really find exactly the right kind of doctor or therapist. Over the course of weeks, months, and then years, ended up consulting everyone from neurologists, rheumatologists, acupuncture people, acupressure, muscular therapists, physical occupational therapists, even, well, hand surgeons. And I had everything from, you know, blood work done to MRIs, because the problem itself was not easy to detect. It was not a gross problem. It was subtle, and a lot of well-informed and well-intentioned people had what I think in retrospect was perfectly sound advice. And yet I went for years really without discovering what I now think may have been the right key to kind of trying to undo the damage over, you know, over time and with a certain perspective and with a certain effort.
And what was that key?
Well, there remains a certain degree of mystery about it, but I think that the best advice that I got in 5 or 6 years of looking came from an unexpected and rather humble source, a Feldenkrais practitioner, a Are you a
Feldenkrais is a kind of body education technique.
Exactly. It's often very closely linked with the Alexander technique,
right?
Which has to do with body use and body posture. And this particular therapist, a young woman in San Francisco, seemed to be able to somehow detect a kind of a pattern of holding and of blockage in a way that she gave me certain kinds of stretching exercises to try that, in contrast to other stretching exercises I had been trying and which were suggested to me, these ones seemed to be kind of compound stretching exercises. They involved an awareness of three, four, and five parts simultaneously stretching. And somehow the experience of mobilizing and moving, you know, everything from the pelvic area through up through the back, shoulders, neck, and then down the arm, which was really, you know, the site, so to speak, the locality of the problem. Very, very gradually over a very long time, I somehow managed to regain the use of my hand by incremental degrees, and at the same time had a sort of a greater bodily ease and health, you might say. So there remains for me a kind of blessed mystery about it.
My guest is pianist Andrew Rangel. His latest CD is called A Recital of Intimate Works. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is pianist Andrew Rangel. You injured your hand while recording Beethoven sonatas in the early 90s. Now,
right.
In the mid-80s, you had learned all of the 32 Beethoven piano sonatas, and during much of the second half of the 80s, you were performing the whole cycle over a series of concerts. Since this was such a formative part of your career, and since in the recording of it you injured your hand, I'd like to talk with you about these sonatas.
Yeah.
First of all, why did you want to take on such a really ambitious project? I mean, it must be very thrilling and very frightening and consuming to take on 32 Beethoven sonatas.
What impelled me to take on this enormous commitment and task was, in fact, the loss of a sort of secure academic position at that time. I found myself out of that job and, frankly, very upset by that dislocation and in some distress about what to do. And I actually kind of retreated in a way. I mean, it's odd to describe the undertaking this task as a retreat, but I felt that spiritually it could only be good for me to take a year, more than a year actually, because we're talking about a period from May of 1985 to a first concert in the end of September 1986, to examine and to in effect live inside all of the Beethoven sonatas in some fashion, and then to systematically perform them in a sequence of concerts the next year.
Well, I'm wondering what effect, you know, you said it could only help spiritually to do something like that. It could also drive you crazy. how did the balance finally weigh out there?
Well, I think that to some extent you have to already have the temperament and the wish to explore something in a kind of overwhelming and consuming detail and depth. One might say that the madness is already present. I did, in fact, live for a year. Well, just on a musical level, there is a price to pay for that kind of specialization, which is that you, in effect, really remove yourself from many other realms of and I felt that the richness to be gained in the one really kind of offset for the time being what was sacrificed in terms of all the other repertoire I would have to forsake. I actually have no regrets about that. And also the pressures and the difficulty of eventually performing all of these sonatas was a kind of rigor which, in a way, I was new to in terms of just the professional reality. And that was a very bracing and challenging and anxiety-producing experience, but ultimately a very positive one.
In your liner notes to one of your Beethoven Sonata CDs, you describe one of the pieces as a journey to the innermost places of the heart. Mm. And I'm thinking, in order to actually achieve that through your interpretation of music, you must have to first really learn the mechanics before the heart can really enter into it.
Well, the two processes are intertwined and integrated in a very profound way from a very early age. There is, I think, perhaps a notion out there that, you know, that one learns the notes, that one employs the strategies that makes one able to deal with the physical problems of playing a piece of music. Mm-hmm. And then one attends to the interpretational or emotional or spiritual or the inward side of the music. I think in any serious musician, those two tasks are fused together inextricably from a very, very early age. And in fact, in that particular movement, which I'm sure is the slow movement, the largo movement of the Hammerklavier Sonata, which is a journey of 18 to 20 minutes, the problems are not purely of, or even primarily, physical. You know, I mean, there are no extravagantly difficult physical problems in that movement, in contrast to the rest of the sonata, which is overwhelmingly difficult. But it has to do with all kinds of subtleties of balance and sound and emphasis and pacing and timing that are, you know, gradually learned over, if not a lifetime, at least a long time.
Why don't we hear that? This is the Beethoven Sonata number 29 in B-flat major. This is the Adagio Sostenuto Largo. That's my guest, Andrew Rangel, at the piano. During the period when you couldn't perform, were you playing in your mind? Were you just rehearsing in your mind?
Oh, I would say incessantly, in a way. But
you know, were rehearsing at the piano, too, actually. You
well,
said trying to
sure,
take on things
was,
that were too
I
ambitious.
Was trying, I was trying very hard to to grapple with, and in fact, wading back into the repertoire that I wanted to be performing and which I am performing now. I was struggling with things that I couldn't legitimately do. But even before that, while I wasn't playing at all, I was listening to music, thinking about music. But I seemed to be deprived of being involved in just the way I needed and wanted to be. Although I did try turning to some other things. I don't know whether it can be or ought to be included in the interview, but apart from several other things, children's books and some other things I became involved with, one of the things which I actually pursued in an odd way over several years was playing basketball out
with
on the streets.
Tendonitis?
Well, this was at a point when I was in such despair about my hands. I mean, this may sound unbelievable to you. Even I look back with a kind of amazement that in the wish to kind of somehow free my body and my mind, I started engaging in a very dangerous, enterprise of running around with the neighborhood kids, some of whom were very big, strong, tough, and fast. And this was a kind of almost a drug for me, and it was quite wonderful, but I actually did sustain further injuries, which were kind of a setback. So now I have sort of more or less definitively abandoned basketball.
Wow. It wouldn't have been the first thing I would have thought of to help get over a hand injury.
Well, it was something that I had always loved doing as a kid. Uh-huh. I did athletic things and played tennis also for many years, which I actually am doing now. But it was something that, you know, that was also very interesting for me because I developed a whole relation with an assortment of people that was utterly different from any other connection in my life.
Well, I'm glad that you're performing again. And I thank you so much for talking with us about your music. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Andrew Rangel's latest CD is called A Recital of Intimate Works. This spring, his record label Dorian will release a CD featuring Rangel's 1985 recording of Ravel's Gaspar de la Nuit and his 1977 recording of Beethoven's 32 Variations on a Waltz Theme by Diabelli. Here's a passage from the Beethoven. Coming up, a new memoir by the founder of the literary journal, The Threepenny Review. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. It's an all too rare phenomenon in this country when a small journal of literature and the arts not only survives but flourishes. Happily, though, that is the story with the Threepenny Review, which will soon be celebrating its 20th anniversary. Its founder and editor-in-chief, Wendy Lesser, is herself a rare phenomenon, a writer who's made her literary career outside the mainstream of publishing and academia. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Lesser's appropriately unconventional new memoir called The Amateur.
I've taught a lot of students over the years who've said they wanted to be writers, but I never had one who declared that what he or she wanted to write was the great American novel. In the midst of our seemingly inexhaustible autobiography craze, that ambition has grown unfashionable. Instead, almost all of my aspiring writers want to be like Wendy Lesser, although they don't know that because most have never heard of her. They want, like Lesser, to write occasional first-person nonfiction essays for some wonderful arty magazine. They think they can make a living doing this. Maybe to give myself a break from forever sounding like Professor Killjoy, I should assign the next starry-eyed belletrist who walks into my office Lesser's latest book to read. It's a kind of literary memoir called The Amateur that's loosely constructed out of a series of essays. In it, Lesser talks about founding the Threepenny Review while she was still a PhD candidate in literature at Berkeley. After 10 years, Lesser says, the review eventually got an arts grant that allowed her to pay herself a nominal salary. Today, almost 20 years after its founding, the review has about 9,000 readers and a staff of 1.5 people. And it still operates out of Lesser's old graduate student apartment. I'd like my students with literary ambitions to read The Amateur to see what a successful, independent life of letters looks like, and to see the tough love that literature demands these days. Those of my students and other readers who aren't scared off by Lesser's tale will be invigorated by it. In her introductory essay, Lesser refers to herself as an 18th century man of letters, the one who happens to be female and lives in 20th century Berkeley. Lesser's witty, penetrating writing style, as well as her stickler obsessions with the origins of words, do qualify her as a latter-day inheritor of the Enlightenment tradition of Dr. Johnson. Very occasionally, though, a contemporary smugness creeps into her essays. It's that attitude that Al Pacino in Sea of Love so memorably dubbed the wonder of me. That's the omnipresent danger in all first-person writing. I like the essays in The Amateur best that don't distractingly herald Lesser's own unique sensibilities, but instead just demonstrate what a terrific close reader she is of other people's lives and work. She writes discerningly here about subjects ranging from Mark Morris's choreography to the late Mario Savio's voice to, of course, literature. Here, for instance, is how Lesser defends Dickens' novels against the familiar charge of sentimentality. Most sentimental writing, she says, leaves you sick to your stomach so that you feel sated but sullied when you reach the end of it. Dickens wounds you and then he soothes you. But he leaves you with a residue of what it felt like to be wounded, a tangy bitterness that cleanses the sweetness of the happy ending. That's such a smart, contained observation about Dickens. Lesser's essays are filled with similar smart, contained observations, ones that I savored especially because there's such a pressure in publishing these days to bloat the smallest insight into a grandiose tome about literature, culture, the millennium. In contrast, most of the essays in The Amateur will help readers rediscover the beauty of small proportions. Lesser is aptly named. As a writer and editor, she recognizes that less is often more.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Amateur by Wendy Lesser. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Putumayo World Music, presenting Celtic Tides, featuring the Chieftains, Clannad, and others. Available on CD, video, and DVD, and airing on Bravo on March 18th. And Bantam Books, publishers of Just Like a Woman, How Gender Science is Redefining What It Means to Be Female. Available in hardcover nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with journalist David Goodman about life in post-apartheid South Africa. Also, tired of chicken and fish? Bruce Adels, the co-author of The Complete Meat Cookbook, offers advice on how to shop for and prepare beef. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.